Hey there, my name is Oisin Lunny and this is Audio Matters, a weekly podcast on all things audio presented to you by Harman. This week's episode is called LA Confidential, where we travel to Los Angeles to visit the studios of three of the most brilliant audio professionals on the planet and hear the real life stories of their extraordinary careers. I'm honored to be introducing three very special guests who have more than likely worked on some of your favorite albums of all time, with artists like Steely Dan, Fleetwood Mac, Blondie, Supertramp, Outkast, Tyler the Creator, Doja Cat, Earth, Wind & Fire, Joe Cocker, Toto, Prince, and rock gods Spinal Tap. Welcome to the podcast, Platinum Award-winning producer and engineer and post-production guru, Lanice Bent. Multi-platinum and 2 times Grammy Award-winning producer, mixer, and therapist, Neil Pogue. And film composer, record producer, songwriter, keyboardist, and man of many talents, CJ Vanston. Lanice, you have an amazing career. Amongst other things, you were the first woman to receive an RIAA Platinum album for your engineering of Auto American by Blondie. And you've worked on some really iconic recordings, including Steely Dan's Asia. What was your path into the control room to work with Steely Dan, and what was the experience like?
Oh boy. Well, the very first studio I ever was in was a home studio. It was Leon Russell's friend of mine, Roger Lynn, was his engineer. He said, oh, you should come over and see Leon's studio. And I was a huge fan of Leon Russell. And so I said, sure. And I was studying film at the time. So that day after school, I hurried over to Leon Russell's house in Encino and rang the doorbell, and he actually answered. And I almost fainted. And he said, oh, you must be Roger's friend. Come on in. And I walked into the foyer, and to the right, where a dining room typically is, and that's what the room was this amazing control room with this wonderful music coming out. It was a record called Will of the Wisp. That's what they were working on, that one. And I walk in and I see this console, and I see this Stevens 40-track tape machine, and I see monitors, and I see outboard gear, and I just had my epiphany, and I said, show me how to work this. And the next day, I dropped out of university and found a recording school, Soundmasters, and signed up, and then went home and told my parents what I had done. And they were thankfully very cool about it. So from then on, I would go to Soundmasters Monday and Wednesday nights. And then, because I wasn't in university anymore, Tuesdays and Thursdays, I would go over to Leon's house, and Roger would let me practice what I had learned in class the night before. So Roger would let me come over and go, here's an 1176. This is what limiting does. Here's a compressor. There's an LA-2A. This is what compression sounds like. And then I got to practice, and it became very clear to me that if you know what you're doing, your environment can really support that. So when I graduated, I looked around for jobs, got one at the Village as an assistant engineer. My goal was to work with the best producers and engineers and musicians in the best studio with the best equipment. So I arranged that and, by getting a job at the Village. Then I assisted on a variety of things. My very first day at the Village, my very first session was with Alice Coltrane, and it was a tracking day. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I started there, and then I heard that Steely Dan was coming into the studio, and there were 6 assistants, and only one was going to get this, so I knew I had to work twice as hard to get it than anybody else, and a friend of mine worked at Warner Brothers, so I asked him to get me all of their records. And I just listened to every single one, read all the credits, learned every song and what their sound was, who played on what their style was. I just totally educated myself. So I would be prepared, because I was determined to get this, and also terrified if I did. And I have to say, when I got it, that was great. And I knew it was going to be a very long project. And one of the reasons I got it was because I was willing to work on something that was going to take virtually a year to record. And the other assistants didn't want to work on something that long. I was fine with that because I knew the integrity of the project would be incredibly valuable. So the first day we worked on a song called When Josie Comes Home, Josie. So I was just totally intimidated. And it took me about 2 months before I understood their language, Donald and Walter and Gary Katz, the producer. CJ mentioned earlier that, you know, part of sessions and all that was about 15 minutes of joking around and funny and having a good time and all that. Not so much with them. The musicians certainly did that. And Roger Nichols was hysterically corny in all his, you know, really bad techno jokes and stuff. But Donald and Walter did not really do any small talk. But that was kind of intimidating for a while until I got comfortable with them and realized they weren't being snooty or weird or anything. That's just how they were, you know, and it was okay. And we got to be really good friends, but I worked on that record 10 and a half months. And
wow.
Yeah. And with the best people, I mean, I've got some of the most incredible memories, especially when Wayne Shorter came in to do the solo on Asia. Donald wanted him to be on it, got his number and called him, and Wayne didn't know who he was. And Donald left him a message, and so Wayne didn't call him back. And and Donald was really hurt, and so he called the studio manager, Dick LaPalme, who used to be with Chess Records and all. And Dick called Wayne and said, "You trust me, you really want to play on this record." And so Wayne came, and it was such a monumental day. Donald always had, he was kind of hunched over and kind of played with his hair and kind of, you know, was kind of like this and, you know, would wear these funny t-shirts and stuff. And that day he actually stood up straight and had this beautiful white striped ironed button-down shirt and just showed the utmost respect to Wayne. And Wayne went in there for about half an hour and did 6 passes and then left. And Roger comped it. And there you have it.
Amazing. There's so much serendipity there. So Wayne Shorter almost didn't appear on the album at all. That's incredible. Thank you. Neil, Lanise mentioned Soundmasters, and I believe that played a role in your past as well. Tell us about the connection and how that acted as a springboard for you.
I was in a band at the time. I guess 1984 is when I moved to California from Jersey. I was in a band. Well, not a band. It was me and this other guy. We were like the Black Hall & Oates. So we came to California with big dreams, you know, with our demo tape and wanted to find a record deal. And at that time I was playing drums, but things didn't work out according to plan. So he moved back to Jersey and I stayed. You know, I was trying to find some studio work or maybe find some touring gigs or something. That didn't work out. But being that I was always the producer in the band, you know, I was the guy that would always stay and you know, try to find out what the whole studio vibe was about. You know, I loved all the knobs and faders and lights and all that stuff. And, you know, the VU meters, I used to love that stuff. And you just sit in the back and watch the engineer, you know, mix or record. And I was intrigued by it. After my friend went back to Jersey and I stayed, I was like, you know, I was looking through I think it was the Music Connection. And I found an ad for the Soundmasters. And I was like, okay, let me take a shot at that. You know, let me go to school. Because really, I wasn't thinking about being an engineer. I wanted to learn how to engineer my productions.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, let me go there. And so I went to Soundmaster and, you know, it was cool. I went there for a couple of years. And then after, I mean, long story short, after that, I had a friend that was already here. It was a friend that I met through my aunt And he knew Michael Jackson's brother, Randy. And so I got a gig. Randy had a home studio. And so I had worked there for a little bit as an assistant. One day we had did a gig at Larrabee. So I was there and I had met the owner, Kevin Mills. And at the time he was looking for assistants. And so I had asked Randy if it was okay to take the gig, you know, because I just didn't want to leave and, you know, and not talk to him about it. But he was like, yeah, just, you know, go for it. And so I left Randy and I went to Larrabee, which I thought was the Holy Grail. Yeah. I started assisting there and met my mentor, a guy named Tabe Mote. So he was kind of my sensei. I learned a lot from him. But yeah, that was my journey from Soundmaster and what I went through. And, you know, because a lot of people thought that I lived in Georgia first, but no, I'm a Jersey kid that came here to California. And then I went to Georgia in 1990 after thinking that California was a little congested on finding gigs and everything. But working at Larrabee was great. You know, at that time, they were working on a lot of R&B records and a lot of rock records. You know, I met a lot of great, great people like Richard Perry and U2 came through there and Janet Jackson came through there. I mean, a lot of great people came through there. Prince came through there. It was a really cool time in the late 80s. So I was there at Larrabee from 88 and I left there probably early 1990.
Thank you, Neil. That's an amazing path so far. You took some really courageous decisions and followed your heart. Brilliant. Now, I would love to jump over to you, CJ. Surrounded as you are by racks of awesome gear, it just looks incredible. Tell us about your studio, The Treehouse.
I'm in an industrial park, really ugly building that no one would ever think twice about. For me, I take off the Superman cape when I walk out this door and come home as Clark Kent. One of the things I like doing here is, for instance, I did a Toto's last record, Toto 14, and had the band sitting in the control room. I got 6 headphone stations, and I put the microphone right in the middle of the floor in the control room, and we all wore headphones, no talkback, so I didn't have to, because running the talkback when 6 guys are all trying to talk to someone in the booth, not happening. No. So it really made communication great, and it's a very intimate environment here. Everybody that walks in, they go, oh, this place is so cozy. I go, that's cool. Right on. The only person that didn't say that was Joe Cocker, came here. I was producing a record for him, and I said, hey, why don't we try and do some vocals at my studio? You know, there's no reason to rent out Capital A to put one mic stand out there, you know? So he came over and he walked in this control room and he said, oh, what a box. And I was like, what? Okay, Joe, whatever. Down the vocal booth. Well, in the next 3 hours, we did 7 finished vocals, final vocals for the record, 7. And so the next day, the record label called me and they said, Joe wants to know if he can do his whole record at your studio. Because it was just the 2 of us here. You know, I engineer everything myself. I really like having that one-on-one relationship with the artist. And, you know, the stories that get told when there's not other people in the room, it creates an intimate bond between me and the artist. And, you know, as you guys all know, a trust is what needs to be established for someone to bare their soul and then for you to be able to critique them and work with them. Trust is a big issue. So that intimacy of this room really, really works. It's a really, really, the place is conducive for that.
Amazing. I love Joe Cocker's reaction. Absolutely priceless. And listeners, check out the show notes for a very special video tour of the Treehouse that CJ has very kindly recorded for us. It is an incredible space full of mouth-watering vintage gear and some gems for avid Spinal Tap fans like myself. Lanice, tell us a bit about the process of working at your home studio.
One of the projects I recently did was a French artist, and she wanted me to produce 4 songs for her. So she came and stayed in the couch that's like right there and that opens up to a bed. And my piano is right on the other side of this monitor that you're looking at me. And so we did all the pre-production here. She stayed here. We cooked. We talked about the arrangements and the direction we wanted the songs to go into. She wrote her charts here. I contracted talent on this side. I recorded the demos. We listen and say, let's move this around. We did all of that could happen right here. And then we went into Evergreen Studios and cut the basic tracks. And the musicians that I contracted, there were three things that they had to be able to do. They had to be able to read music. They had to be able to play multiple instruments, and they had to be kind. And and it was wonderful. So we went in from here. We went to Evergreen the evening before, and as I set up with my assistant and all of that, rehearsed the band and got them all set up and got their sounds and everything, and then went in the next day and hammered out the four songs like crazy. And then and there were some other musicians working in other rooms at Evergreen who came in to hang out, and one of them was Phil Chen, who's a great bass player. He was Rod Stewart's bass player, and all, you know, Do You Think I'm Sexy and all that. Cool. Wow. Chinese Jamaican, fabulous guy. He was totally enamored with the project, and he said, I have to play on this. I have to play on your record. I have to play on your record. So we brought him over here, and he sat on the piano bench and played banjo and played fretless bass. And I sat over here and recorded him. And we just hung out here. And between Brian, my guy, Brian Risner, between him and myself, we got a lot of stuff and a lot of speakers and a lot of instruments and amplifiers and direct boxes and whatever. And you just set it up, whatever you need. And we just had the best time. Phil didn't want to leave. He was here till like about 10 o'clock at night and just hanging out. And that's, to me, that will be a memory that I will have forever that makes it, that vibe is on that record. And that's what's important to me.
Ah, that's beautiful. Yeah, it's such an intimate setting where you're working. You build up a profound relationship with the people you're working with, and that's essentially what gets captured on the records. Listeners, if you would like to check out those recordings produced by Lanise, just have a look for Clara Bellino's album called Unexpected. And the tracks featuring Phil Chen are I Came Here and Bobby's song, Talking with Angels, which were indeed recorded in Lanise's living room. Neil, I wonder, could you continue taking us on your career journey from Larrabee onwards up until working with Outkast?
When it comes to Outkast, I met those guys when they were in high school. I'm about 10 years older than them, but I was working with a production crew called Organized Noise down in at Atlanta. And at the time, we were working on another project. And so Outkast would, you know, I don't think they were even called Outkast yet, but they used to come straight from school to the studio. And, you know, they would just sit around and be flies on the wall and bring their rhymes. And, you know, they would talk to the guys of Organized Noise. That's like a three member production crew with Ray, Rico, and Pat. And so they would come down and show them their rhymes and you know, and I guess Organized Noise would kind of just have them there just to learn the ropes and see how they work, and you know, just have them come down every day just to be used to the process. And at the time, like, I guess on the side they would do tracks for them and, you know, go through demos and stuff. And at that time they were looking for a record deal for the guys, and they would do showcases for L.A. Reid, and L.A. Reid turned them down about two or three times. At the time he had the LaFace records with Babyface. So one day I was sitting next to L.A. and we were working on this, because I knew L.A. here in Los Angeles LA, who is personally known as Antonio Reed. And so I was sitting there working with him on a Whitney Houston, Bobby Brown track. What was it called? We Have Something in Common. It was a remix. And so at that time, Organized Noise would keep bugging him and, you know, and trying to get Outkast signed. And so he was sitting there and he got a call. And after he hung up, he asked me, he said, "What do you think about this Outkast?" And I said, "I think they're great. I think you should sign them." He was like, "Okay, cool." And he put, you know, and he signed him just based on that. A lot of people don't know that story, but he turned around and asked me, and I was like, "What are you asking me for?" You know, so he asked me, and I told him the truth. I was like, "I think they're great. Okay, cool." And that's how it went down.
Incredible. So many things almost didn't happen. We heard about Wayne Shorter's sax solo on Asia, and how Outkast may not have even had a deal if you hadn't had that conversation. Neil, are you seeing a move towards recordings with more live performances these days?
I'm part of this movement of bringing live instrumentation back, you know. So I don't like to cut anything but live, you know. And so about a year ago, I created a production team with me, Verdine White from Earth, and Fire, and the drummer John Paris from Verdine White. So we're a production crew now. So going back to the whole social thing is we like to have that social feeling where people come in and we cut. And also we love to cut to analog tape first. We cut the drums and the bass to analog, and then we take that and transfer it to Pro Tools. So there's certain rules that we have about keeping, you know, certain integrity and that sound.
You know, with Spinal Tap, we had a different approach. We recorded to analog, but transferred it to Pro Tools and back to give it that nice digital harshness. You
know. Fantastic. Yeah. Amazing. That's a pro tip right there. Thank you, CJ. So we've already heard about the career journeys of Lanise and Neil to where they are now. CJ, what's your origin story?
I mean, I came up, my first studio work was in Chicago doing jingles. And I quickly rose to become the number one guy in town there for about 10 years. Worked for 35 different producers and was doing five or six sessions a day, mm-hmm. 1 hour sessions. Yeah. I had two keyboard rigs. These things were moving around the town, hop in a taxi, walk right in. Here's 40 pieces from the Chicago Symphony. Walk in. The next thing is a country thing. Next thing is a jazz feel. Next thing. So it was a great training ground and working with different studios, different engineers. I finally decided I got to come out to LA and make records. I didn't learn all this to make the sound of flying shrimp for Red Lobster. You know,
of course, probably paid better.
Right, right.
All the money was
hours, right?
Yeah. The only problem is it was a lot of money, and I was in my 20s in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to leave it there. All right.
Yeah.
Leave that sit right there.
Sounds like all of us.
So anyway, I came up to LA, and the jingle producer, the top guy in Chicago's name was Dick Marks, and his son was Richard. And Richard was out here, and his dad said, "You got to use this guy on a song." He said, "There's keyboard players, you know, there's 100 keyboard players out here. Why do we need this guy?" And he says, "Just give him a shot on a song." And so Richard said, "Here's a cassette of a song. It's not even for a record. Maybe we can put it in a film or something." I said, "I got it." And I listened to it. I made the demo. The demo, he put the vocal on. We put a nylon guitar on. That's all it is. The rest of the record is all me. The demo was what went on the record. And the song was called Right Here Waiting. Mm. One of the big hits of the 80s.
Huge.
Huge number one hit. So that's the first song I did in LA. So now the phone starts ringing. "Hi, it's Phil Ramone. I don't know if you know me. I've been hi, it's Desmond Child. Hi, it's, you know," I started doing sessions here and working around and did some live gigs. And this one live gig, it was at the Roxy. We played this gig and the sound man came up and said, "Hey, my boss would love you. Where are you from? Who are you?" And I said, "I just moved to town." He goes, "Oh my God, my boss would flip." I said, "What's your boss's name?" He said, "Don Henley." I said, "Don Henley? Oh, seriously?" And he had just done the End of the Innocence record. Mm-hmm. And I knew that record by heart. And so he said he's looking for keyboard players for his tour. So they auditioned, I think, 42 guys or something like that. But that Bruce Hornsby stuff, I grew up playing in church. Like, I didn't have to learn how to play like Bruce Hornsby. I already did that. So I went in and aced it. They called me for a second callback, aced it again, went for the third callback. Finally, it came down to me and another guy. And I got the gig. And they called and they said, you know, you've got the gig, but there's one stipulation. Don wants you to shave your beard. I said, I'm sorry? They said, yeah, Don wants you to shave your beard. I said, well, I might shave my beard one day if I get up and decide I'm going to shave my beard today, but I'm not shaving my beard because someone tells me to. No. They said, well, you know, this is a stipulation for the gig. I said, well, I'm not shaving my beard. I'll talk to you later. Because I knew they would call back and go, okay, you know, okay, you got the gig. No, they didn't. I didn't get the gig. I was heartbroken. I just thought, I've just blown my whole career. I've ruined my whole career. So a couple of weeks later, Katie Sagal, the actress from Married with Children, great singer, is at a party. And she goes up to Don Henley and says, hey, you know, I'm putting a band together. I'm going to do a thing in town and make a record. And I need a keyboard player. And he goes, well, I know a great guy, but he's got an ugly beard. So Katie Sagal calls me to be in her band. She sends me her charts and stuff, and I demo everything out. I, you know, make tracks top to bottom that, you know, sound pretty good for, and you guys talk about real instruments. I consider the synthesizer a real instrument because it's me playing it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they have the first rehearsal and the drummer walks in. I go, are you Russ Kunkel? And he goes, yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, Russ Kunkel is in the band. This is insane. So Russ sits down. He says, what are we doing? I said, well, here's the demo. I played it and he goes, oh, excuse me, stop. What am I hearing right now? I said, well, that's the demo. He goes, no. But who did this? I said, I did. Yeah, but who played bass? I said, that's me. Who did the drums? I said, I programmed those. Who did the? I said, I did everything. Who mixed this? I said, I did. He goes, okay, I got two people you got to meet. He introduced me to Greg Ladani, who was my key to meeting Toto, Joe Cocker, and many other artists. I ended up working with him for 25 years. And the other person he introduced me to was Christopher Guest.
Oh.
And I got the job as keyboardist in Spinal Tap and ended up doing 9 movies for Christopher Guest out of this because I didn't shave my damn beard. I stood up for myself. And the lesson is you got to follow your gut.
Never cutting my beard again, CJ.
And it just led to so many great things. And I ended up meeting these incredible people that I'm still working with. Well, Greg unfortunately passed away. I've got his ashes sitting up here and his Merlin sitting right there that he mixed, always had on his console. So Greg's up there and he was like my best friend. It was a tough loss.
I'm so sorry.
So was that. Ed Cherney was a, you know, one of my best friends. Phil Ramone was like an uncle to me. 89, I'm working with Phil Ramone on a record with a group, band called Boy Meets Girl. And the record, by the way, got shelved because the A&R guy got fired. So they just shelved the record. We made this amazing record that nobody ever heard. But so I sat with Phil, and Phil was so much fun to work with. His stories are better than anybody's. You know, him and Quincy together, just you can't get a word in edgewise. So anyway, I got this program, an anagram maker for my computer. It was one of the Macs with the floppy drives back then. And I anagrammed Phil Ramone's name. And his anagram was Mr. Painhole.
Wow.
So I always called him Mr. Painhole, and he loved it. He called me on the phone. He'd go, Vanston, it's Painhole. So it was Mr. Painhole. That's, you know, he's like an uncle to me, you know. And that's the thing we were talking about earlier about people. This is a family, you know. You want to create a family situation. Mm-hmm. And musicians are the funniest people in the world. Their sense of humor is so great. The hang, getting the jokes told, hanging out, getting that brotherhood, getting that feel of being together is so important. Ed Cherney, I would do records with him, and we'd be out joking around, Kenny Aronoff and me and Keltner and all these great musicians telling stories. And it's like 45 minutes goes by. It's like, what are we going to record? So finally, we go in and go, you know, is there a demo we can listen to? And Ed go, oh, yeah, sure. And he'd play it. Ed was just letting us hang. He knew it was creating the vibe. He wasn't, we thought, you know, he's not keeping track of time. No, he knew that was important to getting a team,
time well spent,
a bond.
I did a session with Ed Cherney once, and before that session with Ed Cherney, I was assisting engineers that it almost like they had this code of being assholes. It's like they just wanted you to, you know, to crawl and suffer, and you know, they wanted you to have pain in, you know, in your life. You know what I'm saying? But Ed would come in, and he had this light. He would come and just smile and have fun. And, you know, and I've always been this nice guy. And so when I saw these other engineers back when I was coming up, I thought, oh, maybe that's how you're supposed to be. You're supposed to treat assistants like scum, you know what I mean? So he came in and was like just a joy to work with. And he taught me like, it's okay to be a nice guy.
It's interesting that you're all masters completely of your instruments, your mixing boards, the technology, the equipment, and every aspect of the audio process. But as CJ said, it is so much about the emotional connection and the trust that you inspire and you bring out of the people who work with you.
Oh, yeah. If there's no emotional response to the music, it's like, what is it then? It's nothing. If the audience or the emotion isn't there, that's what the goal is about a good song. It creates an emotional response. And so, one, it's always about the song and then about the performance and production of the song. But the song comes first, and it has to, like, I have to get goosebumps and tears in my eyes. I cry a lot. Out of them, you know, I hold it back, but I'm not the only one in the room crying, you know? That's important.
Yeah, beautiful. One thing I've noticed about all of you is that you give back to the community. Lanice, yourself through Sound Girls and many other organizations. How important is it for all of you to give back and to encourage the next generation of audio professionals?
It's so important. I feel bad for these kids, you know. All three of us came up working in different studios, and me as a session keyboard player, I worked with all the great producers. It's just an insane list, and all the great engineers, all the great musicians, hundreds of them, mm-hmm. and all the great studios. And so that is over. Kids today aren't going to be able to get that, and they need to be exposed to other people's views and how they do stuff. And I think the old school is important. Kids, you got to learn your history, man, and go back and read some liner notes and see who engineered it and see what studio it was and follow the path, you know? So when I get to go talk to kids, I really like being able to educate them on their roots, and they're standing on the shoulders of giants. Mm-hmm. They need to know who those giants are that paved the way before them.
Back in the day, you know, we took pride in being different. You know, like you would not go near another person's sound. That was like, you know, that was, you just wouldn't do it.
No, you know? It was already there.
Yeah, you know, right.
You need another one.
Right. Know? But yeah, credits was, I was a credit junkie. Like I wanted to know who played what, who produced it, who wrote it, who did this, who did that.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking about the changing landscape of how people are consuming music. There are less accurate credits, as you said, and we also have this pipe to the universal jukebox where almost everything is available 24/7. But one of the interesting things that's happening, and we actually spoke about this on the first episode of the Audio Matters podcast, is that during the lockdown, people have been rediscovering the art of active listening. And there seems to be something interesting happening to our relationship with culture, with music, with art. What's your take on this, CJ?
I've been predicting that we have an amazing awakening that's going to be happening from this. And this is a traditional thing. You look after World War I, you had the Roaring Twenties. After World War II, you had the 50s and all the joyous music and the birth of rock and roll. And then Vietnam and 60s and JFK and all that brought on the greatest, from the late 60s through the 70s, if you just start making the list, matter of fact, we were making the Toto record, and I said, you know why we're so damn good at what we do? Look at what we listen to. Look what we listen to. I just said, I'm just going to throw, and I said, you know, Stevie Wonder, and someone said, you know, Cat Stevens, and I said, Seals and Crofts, Jethro Tull, and we just started going down, Gentle Giant, Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
10cc.
We just started going this wormhole, and it was 15 minutes, and we're still naming artists, and everyone was such an individual sound.
Right.
And anyway, so I'm back to what I was saying. I think there's a rebirth that's going to be coming out of this. People have had to slow down a little bit, and I think music's value has only been increased by this time, this difficult time we're going through. I always tell people, you are what you listen to. Mm-hmm. And when I hear guys my age say, oh, there's no good music anymore. And I just go, dude, so what are you listening to? What are you listening to? Tell me what you're listening to. And it's like a blank. Like, there's so much great stuff out there. So much great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. There's a band called Phoenix out of France that I'm just enamored with. These guys. So damn good. So you are what you listen to. And you know, all three of us, I know, when we were teenagers, listened to everything. Everything. Stop listening to records.
Yeah.
And I think it's more fractal now. These kids have got so many other things to do and so much stimulus coming at them that it's been pushed aside. It's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah.
The more technology that we have, I think the worse it gets. I think we just have to learn how to use it.
Right.
But I think we use it in a way where we forget where we come from. You know, it's like we're so busy moving forward that we forget where we came from and how to take that and incorporate it and make something greater out of it.
Yeah. It's like when you see people going to, they're on vacation or whatever, and they're on a tour of the Sistine Chapel, let's say, or something, and they're all looking through their iPhones or their cameras. And they're not just actually looking at it themselves. You want to say, just put those things away. Right. And like at concerts, everybody's texting and having to film. You see the people filming a concert, you know, they're never going to watch that thing again. Right. And they're missing actually the experience of just being in the concert, being in the club, being in the music.
Well, but you know, the other thing is economically, you think about being a young musician now. I mean, when I was 18, I got a loan for $10,000, which I looked up would be about $76,000 now. I got a loan and I bought a Yamaha CP70. I bought a Mini Moog. I bought an Oberheim 4-voice and a Rhodes. And it was like the most badass rig, you know. And I paid it off by playing in clubs 6 nights a week. And what kid can do that today?
Neil, I'm wondering, what do you see personally in the world that gives you hope?
Just seeing, you know, how everybody's coming together right now. I feel that everybody in the world is finally on the same frequency.
Right on.
And because this feels like a war. Mm-hmm. So after every war, I think great things come out of it. I always tell people, you know, great things come out of tragedies, unfortunately. A lot of great things. And I always think, you know, God doesn't make mistakes. And I always think that God is the biggest comedian ever, because sometimes if you look at the world, you kind of have to laugh at it, because right now, being that the music business has kind of got one-sided, in a way, because I always think that everything can coexist in this business. Everything can, as long as it's good. But things haven't been so great lately. So I think out of this, I think great music is going to be coming out of it. I think a lot of the songwriting is going to be better. I think a lot of what we do is just going to, I think a lot of great music is going to happen now. I think it's going to become the soundtrack of our lives, because, you know, in the 70s, you really had some great music. You had great production teams, you know, like the Philly sound, which, you know, because everything kind of came out of the civil rights movement, you know, out of the late 60s into the early 70s. You had all this great music that came out of everything that had happened up until that time, you know. You know, you had What's Going On by Marvin Gaye, all this great music that came out of that. So I think that's going to happen now, too. A lot of great things are going to come out of what we're going through.
Yeah. Well, you know, great artists turn pain into pleasure.
Most definitely.
Turn chaos into order. Mm-hmm. And they speak for an entire generation sometimes with what they create. And we need those artists now. And I think that's one of the great things about making music is it helps us personally deal with our pain. Mm-hmm. We have a way to process all that pain. So it's a call to arms right now to songwriters, especially. We need some great songs.
Yeah.
I think so. And collaboration, universal collaboration, the fact that technology allows us to collaborate like we're doing right now. You know, once they get latency issues sorted out and all of that, but it's an international, global event now. Instead of, you know, we're limited by our location or who can fly in or who can't or the budgetary or anything like that. This is really facilitating our ability to have a global musical, creative, collaborative presence.
Awesome. Right. There are people that push away the technology now, especially when they rag on Spotify and Apple Music and things like that. These are the greatest tools we've ever had.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It reaches globally.
It needs to be embraced, not pushed away. And that's unfortunately what people do when they get old, is they push away new things, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. That's why we got to incorporate both. We really do. Right. Just incorporate both and just make something great. That's what it's about.
A great song wins every time.
Right. That's right. It's about the song first, not about technology. Yes. It really is.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Just wonderful. Thank you. So I have one more question for all of you. What piece of advice would you give to your younger selves?
I would say my younger self would be patience. I always think about patience first, you know, because being in this business, you have to have the patience because it's such a competitive field. And I think it's about not worrying about the next guy. You have to hone in on yourself and, of course, use all of your influences to create who you are. And during that moment, I think you have to build patience in order to fight through all this congestion of the music business. There's so many of us doing the same thing. And how can one guy stick out and get that gig? Is it luck? Some people say it's luck. Some people say it's fate. Whatever. But I think you just have to work hard and have a lot of patience.
Great advice. Thank you.
I would say for me, one of the things that comes up would be get your business together. Figure out how to save money and how to collect your money and how to charge the right rate. Get a songwriter contract when you write a song with the splits on it. You know, I was so bad at so much of that. I gave away literally millions of dollars because of not asking for. I wrote a bridge for a number one song and didn't even ask for songwriting credit. That's terrible, you know?
Yeah.
No, that's important. And save your money. And also if you know what that thing is that you're passionate about, it's okay to work at other things so you can afford to follow through on that passion. Right now, the music business is challenging. To apply your skills in such a way that you can afford to do that thing you love. I do a lot of things because I want to be able to record music, and I don't always make the money I would like to make doing music, but it's my passion and it's what I want to do. It's the palette I paint with and the, the instruments I play are the technology, and to have the joy of doing that, I can do post-production. I can do archival work. I can do supervising. I can dialogue edit. I can record Foley. I can talk about it. I get paid a lot often more to talk about engineering than I do actually engineering. All of these things to diversify, and it's okay not to be so linear and myopic perhaps, because you want to build a pyramid, not a totem pole. So if a brick gets pulled out from the bottom of that pyramid's still going to stand. You have a totem pole and you pull something out, chances are it may collapse. So, and take care of your health. Be healthy. I had to take a big break after the Blondie record because during that time I did about at least 9 records in 1 year with Mike Chapman, and it was wild and crazy and intense, and I ended up getting cancer. And the day after I finished mastering the Blondie record, I drove to Mexico to the cancer clinic, and the doctor said, quit your job or die. And so here I was, you know, platinum record, crash. And I didn't work for 8 years and got well, but I, you know, the universe intervened and said, boy, if you're not smart enough to be healthy and take care of yourself, I'm going to help you out with this. And you're just going to quit. And that wasn't something I wish would have happened, but that's what happened. And get sleep when you can, eat well, get exercise, you know, honor, you know, self-care is absolutely vital.
So some great advice there for anyone who wants to follow in the legendary footsteps of our special guests. Thank you so much, CJ Vanston, Neil Pogue, and Lanice Bent for joining us for this LA Confidential special edition and sharing your extraordinary life stories. Listeners, don't miss a single helping of audio goodness. Make sure to subscribe to the Audio Matters podcast presented to you by Harman using your favorite podcast app. Also, check out the brilliant title playlist chosen every week by our guests, with a few from myself as well. And finally, remember to watch the video tour of CJ Vanston's awesome studio, The Treehouse. You can find all the details in the episode notes. Join us next week when we celebrate Make Music Day with Aaron Friedman, the president of the Make Music Alliance, and Lee Whitmore, the executive director of the Grammy Music Education Coalition. Tune in to explore the power of music, the importance of music education, and learn why your brain on music is a better brain. See you next week.